Is America going the way of the Roman Empire? A growing number of Christians think so, and I'm one of them.
Rod Dreher talking about his presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That's why I say that Christians today should take a new look at the way the early Benedictine monks, who emerged out of the ruins of Rome, responded to the collapse of their civilization. We can learn from them how to build stable lives of prayer, Bible study, and worship in strong communities. The Benedict option, as I call it, is not about running away from the world. It's about learning the practices of discipleship that enable us to stand firm for Christ against the world for the sake of the world.
You can meet and hear Rod Dreher making the case for the Benedict option at the Fall Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. Child care is free. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
If James Madison or Thomas Jefferson were to come back to the United States, their first response would be, what is the Department of Health and Human Services, and what gives it the authority to tell an order of nuns that they have to provide coverage for contraception in their health care plan?
God deeply, dearly, profoundly loves every single human being. To entertain racist thoughts is to be anti-love, to be anti-God and anti-truth.
You can hear the same sort of, oh, the worst sort of sin is to judge or to be self-righteous. Well, guess what? That's what the whole world thinks is the worst sin. These are the prophets of our age, and they must be condemned.
I'm Vicky.
And I'm Ron from Ontario, Canada.
Confessional Lutherans who play in German polka bands, love issues, etc.
We hear this term nowadays, white privilege, and it evokes a picture, doesn't it? Usually a male, white. Me, okay? I grew up in the suburbs. Never wanted for a thing in my life. We were not rich. We were not poor. We thought middle class, and the streets were clean and they were safe, and I rode my bicycle. It was almost like Leave It to Beaver, except the cars were a little bit better. And that's the picture that we often have of a male who's grown up to adulthood now and has never really had to work for anything. Society has kind of opened its doors to him. And that's what we mean when we talk about white privilege. Of course, that ignores an entire segment of the white population in the United States, sometimes called the working poor, the underclass, or something like that. And that also evokes a picture. There was a memoir written last year by J.D. Vance, Hillbilly Elegy, that was very honest, very stirring, very striking picture of growing up in that life, a life that was not one of white privilege. Greetings, welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Thursday afternoon, August the 24th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the religious practices of the white working poor. Terry Mattingly will be our guest a little bit later. Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer joins us for our weekly series, Christ in the Old Testament. Isaiah 51 is the location, the Lord's comfort for Zion and its inhabitants. Dr. Andrew Steinman joins us to respond to a claim recently made by televangelist and President Trump advisor Paula White. She compared President Trump to Queen Esther of the Old Testament. We'll see what Dr. Andrew Steinman, professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University Chicago, has to say about that. Then we'll talk about embryo adoption. Sounds like a great idea, but when you look at the actual numbers and when you talk about what the industry that is behind it does in order to get those embryos, you have to have some questions in your mind. Katie Schuern will be our guest, author of the book, He Remembers the Barren. You can join us with questions or comments over the course of the next 2 hours of Issues Etc. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the religious practices of the white working poor, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's author and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Why, when that picture comes to mind of the white working poor, why do we often assume that this segment of the American population is practicing religious, that is, church-going religious, and is that assumption true?
Well, first of all, I think there's a certain image in American life of small town and rural America, and that includes lots of people at church dinners and dinner on the grounds, and it's like Little House on the Prairie. We kind of picture that as like as if that was what rural America is like. So you have several different population groups here. But rural America, small town America would definitely be part of that image. Now, when you move that to urban life, and we start thinking of the urban poor, I don't think people put religion and church as much in the picture. Ironically, and I guess accurately, they would say for African Americans in urban settings, they might picture them being in church in higher numbers, you know, than might be expected. But this image of simple American people being very religious is actually just not true anymore. And the whole idea that there is a lot of stability out in small town and rural America has come crashing down with the reality of the opioid crisis. And it's finally beginning to get a little bit or a lot of media attention, when if this was almost any other social group, it would have been a huge issue long ago. It was interesting when I was talking to the pastor, the Alabama pastor that I interviewed this week for a column on a topic related to this. You know, we joked around about the old joke that in your typical southern town, the Episcopalians were the people with master's degrees. The Methodists were the people with college degrees. The Baptists were the people with high school degrees. And the Pentecostal and independent Holy Rollers were the people who never finished school at all. That was supposed to be your stereotype of how these groups related. Today, people would be all over the map on that. The New South is a lot more complex than that old stereotype. But the emerging evidence is that people without high school degrees and the people with the lowest incomes are actually now among some of the least churched people in American life. And like you said, I don't think that has soaked in for many people as the reality.
So do you have any thoughts, having basically worked the religion beat your entire journalistic career, why that is? Why is it that in decreasing numbers even, the white working poor, however you want to term them, are less and less religious and churchgoing?
Well, I think part of the problem is out of sight and out of mind. To some degree, our denominations don't think of that as promising church plant territory. I mean, how many religious denominations, when it comes time to plant a new church, with the expensive and risky proposition that is, says, why? Look, this area down in the old warehouse zone surrounded by railroad tracks, man, we haven't had a church down there in 50 years. Why don't we put one there? I mean, that's probably not how they think. They tend to say, well, look, I mean, I'm being sarcastic here, and I apologize. Look, here is an entire zone of mega mansions going up out there on the second loop outside the city, and we don't have a church within 30 minutes of there. The population is going to increase 80% in the next 10 years. The average income is $100,000 plus. Boy, they can support a pastor. I mean, right? For a lot of people, even in the Southern Baptist Convention, the convention in which I grew up, when you talked about the urban poor and when you talked about blue-collar America in urban settings, that was automatically assumed to be home mission territory. In other words, it was explicitly considered a ministry to a challenged underclass. Something similar to doing foreign missions, only now you were going to do it at home. And I would say that would have been the attitude 50 years ago. I'm in my 60s. My father was a home missionary for a while and related to the Home Mission Board. So I speak that language fairly fluently. And these people would not have been looking down on those people at all. Quite the opposite. They would have tremendous compassion for the challenges they face. But they would have faced head on the realities that this is a mission environment, not a traditional church environment. If I could flash it back even a decade or two earlier than that, I mean, don't forget all the work that Eleanor Roosevelt and other people did in the 30s and 40s to try to get America to understand the realities of poverty in Appalachia and all of the towns that were built and the work projects that were built. I live in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and we have inexpensive electricity to this day because of the Tennessee Valley Authority, one of the largest work projects of that era. So the government has known a lot about family dysfunction, alcohol, and other things in hillbilly country for a long time. Just Americans just don't like to think about that all that much. I mean, they'd rather deal with a sitcom like Beverly Hillbillies or something like that than try to think of what the region's actually like.
You have recently written about an encounter at a Waffle House, of all places,
yeah,
that kind of highlights where it is sometimes the rural poor are gathering and are, even in an informal way, approximating what many people seek on Sunday morning.
Yeah. Now, if our listeners are not from a region that has a Waffle House, Waffle House is in about 25, 26 states of the Union, and they are omnipresent in the American South. Their distinct architecture, the yellow, the big yellow sign that says Waffle House, and the menus where you can walk in and hold the menu just as a laminated sheet of paper. And if you've happened to have been partying really hard, you can order just by pointing at the pictures. I mean, it's a really basic diner experience. And it isn't just for the poor. I mean, all kinds of people go to Waffle House. But the expectations of Waffle House, they really are kind of a community. My own Duke University grad school level Orthodox priest here in Oak Ridge, he is a Waffle House aficionado, but then again, you know, he's got graduate degrees from Duke, but he also grew up in a home with an auto mechanic, and the family included sharecroppers in the lowlands of South Carolina. So he gets the Waffle House crowd. Let's just call it a working class diner and say that would explain about 80% of who's at Waffle House. And the fact that it's open 24 hours a day means the fact that that creates an interesting crowd dynamic at different times. There would be people, because the food is so inexpensive, there would be people who eat breakfast at Waffle House every day on their way to work, or almost every day. The pastor I interviewed, I bumped into one of his commentaries online. He's a United Methodist who grew up in trouble himself. I didn't get to include that information in the column, but this is a man who's seen some really rough times himself, including quite a bit of experience with drugs, who then pulled his life together, went to Asbury Theological Seminary, and he's now a church planter. And in Madison, Alabama, he leads a church called One Direction Community. And what's interesting about it is it doesn't include a traditional church building. All of his people meet in house churches, at community meals, and in a center for needy children is where all of his activities occur, both worship, Lord's Supper services once a week, and things of this sort, because he's dealing with people that don't feel that comfortable being invited to church. And he makes the local Waffle House is where he goes every weekday morning and uses it for several hours as his office. And as he put it, once you've done that for about a year and a half, you become a part of the scenery. Everybody there knows you. You know who sits in what pew, so to speak. You know people that sit in booths because they want to be left alone, but they're still listening, which means, you know, they may chime in from time to time. and the people who sit at the middle bar, elbow to elbow. He said, you don't sit there unless you are open to discussing fairly private issues, pushy issues, talkative, etc. And he, you know, my column ends with him saying, it took me over a year to realize that just as some people say that in cities, in big cities, that the bar that someone chooses, you know, don't you wish there was a place where everybody knows your name, that to some degree that's Waffle House in small southern communities.
So that's their church, in essence.
That's their community. And some of the subjects that get raised in a setting like that, I just lost my job again. Oh, my kid has really been rabble-rousing. I don't know what we're going to do about him. Or it's the place where if something terrible has happened in your life and you're sitting over there staring into a coffee cup and people who are there who know you know this isn't your normal behavior, the waitress may kind of sidle down the bar and go, hey, man, what's up? What's the story? And people may or may not talk about it. This pastor had a unique series of experiences lately with a man that he just simply calls Chuck in the column he wrote. And he had a conflict with Chuck because he accidentally sat in Chuck's chair, his pew, because he didn't know Chuck was still there because he didn't spot that the coffee cup had been shoved back and it was kind of next to the sugar and the menus, and he didn't spot it, and he sat in the chair, and Chuck came back in and blew up at him. There's an interesting encounter involving lots of language that we can't use here on the air that I managed to allude to in the column between Chuck and some waitresses. But a couple of weeks later, the pastor has another encounter with Chuck in which Chuck lets it kind of sheepishly looking down says, you know, I've got to go in for a cancer test. And in that conversation, the man opens up, and this man's angry, sullen personality is somehow kind of revealed in the fact that he's a Vietnam vet. And he's utterly convinced that God cannot forgive him for some of the things he did in Vietnam in terms of taking part in raids in which he killed elderly people who were soldiers. They were Viet Cong soldiers and even children that were fighting. And he's just convinced that God will never forgive him. And then even right after that, a week or so after that, in the kind of accident that probably doesn't happen in suburbia very much, this man's son was playing with a handgun that he thought was unloaded, and the clip was out, but there was one bullet in the chamber. And while kind of tossing the gun around and looking at it with somebody, the thing went off and hit him in the head and killed him. Is that church stuff? Well, it would be church stuff if you went to church. But Chuck doesn't go to church, but he knows there's a pastor at Waffle House. So when he knows the pastor's going to show up, that's the kind of day that Chuck smokes a few extra cigarettes in the parking lot so that he runs into the pastor. Is that church?
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We'll talk more with him on the other side of the break about the religious practices of the rural poor. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the Weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. The book, Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Religious liberty, Christians engaging the media, the for you of Christianity, Christian marriage, the sexual revolution, the Benedict option. These are some of the topics for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the religious practices of the white underclass. Terry, I wanted to talk a little bit about this J.D. Vance memoir that came out last year. It was viewed largely through the political lens of the presidential elections and support for Donald Trump, but there's far more to it than that. And really, the long-term impact of that memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, has to do with this guy's honest portrayal of what leads to this life of what one cycle of poverty after another. Does that highlight the very need that's being sought out in places like the Waffle House?
It was criminal that his book got attached so much to Trump. I mean, in the sense that to some degree, yes, he is writing about a region and and people who might be one form of Trump voter. It's also possible to say that that part of the American South and the American Midwest and the Appalachian Territory used to be one of the hotbeds of the Democratic Party and that they've lost it. But somehow attaching Trump to it became just another way to yell at him, you know, or to reject what his book was about. To me, the most heartrending part of his book and what he explicitly says is that most of what's going on in his book are problems the government couldn't possibly solve. And that brings us back to Waffle House, and that brings us back to the sorts of things people talk about there. This pastor that I interviewed, he stressed that, you know, when you lose your job a lot, this has an impact on your family. When you get stressed out and drink a lot, that has an impact on your family. And the breakdown of the families in these circumstances, in the opinion of this pastor, but also in the opinion of J.D. Vance, the breakdown of the families is the story of the region. Because how do you deal with some of these issues if you don't have stable homes, if you don't have environments in which people are safe? And the opioid crisis is calling attention to the fact that there's now something beyond alcohol. There are demons in play here that are even worse than alcoholism. But Vance says over and over that the issue of home and marriage and family and the breakdown of the family in blue-collar America is the real story. This takes me back to the work in the late 60s and early 70s by the great Senator Moynihan of New York, who was a sociologist, I believe, by trade, and taught at Harvard. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote a series of papers about the breakdown of the African-American family. And that was the part of his work that made a lot of tension, got a lot of attention, and caused a lot of tension. What people forget is that Moynihan predicted was that the breakdown of the family, and in particular the breakdown of marriage and children living in situations where there was no father, where there was no family unit to provide shelter and support, Moynihan predicted that that was going to be coming to white culture eventually as well. And in large parts of America, the rate of unwed pregnancy and the percentage of broken families or families that never form, there's not that much difference now between these patterns of poverty among African Americans and Latinos and the white middle and underclass. Now, stop and think about this for a second. How would you build churches to meet those people's needs? The pastor at the Waffle House in Alabama, he says, they're hungry for God. They're hungry to talk about religious subjects. And a lot of them, in a bizarre way, are very religious people. He said, but they are terrified of being judged. And these are the kinds of people whose lives are messed up in ways that they can't hide, as opposed to a lot of the people sitting in more established, pretty church pews, to push that a little bit. These people's lives are messed up in ways that they can't hide. And so they're talking about it at Waffle House. They don't feel they can go to church and be accepted. It's kind of interesting in talking to this pastor. The issue came up. If you were a denominational official, in addition to the issue of where you think you should plant churches that have a high degree of success, would you consider a ministry that's meeting with 150 or so Appalachian blue-collar workers who can't afford to donate any money? Would you consider that mission a success if they don't ever sit in a church pew? I think that raises a real question that our denominational leaders have to think about. What constitutes success when you're working with people whose lives are as brutal, risky, and at times messed up as people who are a part of America's growing and emerging lower middle class and lower class life in rural, small town, and what people think of as Bible Belt or Midwestern religious belt America. But that's just not the reality anymore.
With about a minute, Terry, here, is part of the problem that to one degree or another, American Christianity is hooked on success, and these people, as you say, they can't hide it. They don't look, and they can't pull off looking like our picture of success. About a minute.
Yeah, the image that keeps coming back into my mind is J.D. Vance's grandmother, Mama Vance, who he credits pretty much with saving his life. And this is a woman who at any moment in her life was never more than a couple of feet away from her worn-out Bible and her very well-used gun. She tended to carry both. She had killed a man when she was 12, but that was in a sexual violence situation that she never liked to talk about that much. This was a woman who didn't think she could go down to the local neighborhood church and be accepted. She cussed like a sailor while quoting Bible verses at the same time, constantly. Whose church does she fit in right now? The reality is it's probably a Pentecostal or fundamentalist church, way more than it's going to be, you know, the local franchise of your respectable denomination. And boy, I think that's a question that a lot of our churches have got to be thinking about.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
After the break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Our regular series with him every week is Christ in the Old Testament. We will be traveling to some more familiar territory, Isaiah, and the 51st chapter, the Lord's comfort for Zion. The third and final book in the premier novel series for Christian women is out. The latest in the Anthems of Zion series is titled The Harvest Raise. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Katie Schuerman. Learn more about The Harvest Raise at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Harvest Raise, the Issues Etc. book of the month for August, 1-800-325-3040.
Who is the Holy Spirit? Will there be animals in heaven? How can parents raise Christian children in a hostile culture? This month, find faithful, Bible-based answers to tough theological questions when you subscribe to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's flagship magazine, The Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/trylutheranwitness to get 6 issues for only $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Are you living in central Iowa and longing for a church where the gospel is boldly confessed in all of its purity? Are you tired of hearing the latest purpose-driven How to Live Your Best Life Now TED Talk? Are you desperate to hear the preaching of the cross, which brings you and your children the knowledge, peace, and comfort of the gospel? Then come to Holy Cross Lutheran Church. Located in Carlisle, Iowa, at the southeast corner of Des Moines, we're a short ride from everywhere in the city. Visit our website, holycrosscarlisle.org.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Listen to what you want. When you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pastor Marcus Zill, Director of Campus Ministry and LCMSU, with a prayer for this academic year at our colleges and universities.
Almighty and most merciful God, we ask your blessing on all college students, campus ministry workers, and staff who are joined together on the universities of this land, especially those who bear your name and given the recent events of unrest in Charlottesville. Grant them peace, fill them with high ideals, give them love and goodwill to all people, and above all, keep them faithful to you and your word, even under your Son's most holy cross, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
LCMSU connects and supports Lutheran college students as they face countless challenges to their biblical worldview, doctrine, ethics, and practices. Learn more about their work at lcms.org/lcmsu, lcms.org/lcmsu.